what number do you want to play?
Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
We're back. Saturday night. It's the interwar years. 7:01 p.m. Central Standard Time. Mike, we're going to go to 4:30 and get this podcast on with some Dobro.
Okay. Are you ready?
Yep. Hit it, Mike.
Billy the Bum lived by the thumb, sang of the hobo's delight. He proved he could run twice as fast as the sun by losing his shadow at night. Now he loved every girl in this curly-headed world, but no one will know his fate. About two twisted legs and childhood disease left Billy just a bomb in his dreams. And he was just a gentle boy, a real fluorescent light. Cried pennies on Sunday morning, laughed nickels on Saturday night. Children around Billy's hometown seemed to have nothing better to do than run around his house without tongues from the mouth, making fun of that crippled old fool.
No, you never tire him up.
Some folks are waiting, some folks are praying for Jesus to rise up again. But now these folks in our holy clothes ever took Billy on as a friend. For pity's a crime, it ain't worth a dime to a person who's really in need. Just treat them the same as you would your own name next time that your heart starts to bleed.
What drives ordinary, everyday people to become mass killers? Men and women, but usually men, like you and me. The Holocaust was not perpetrated solely by a few sadistic psychopaths, but by tens of thousands of everyday Germans, Poles, Frenchmen, Austrians, Slovakians. In fact, much of Europe took part. If any of us could be motivated under the right conditions to become mass serial killers, how can we protect, how might we inoculate our societies and cultures from descending into genocide?
One estimate puts the number of victims of genocide and democide, that's murder by government, at 169 million in the 20th century alone. Stalin, Mao, the Khmer Rouge, Rwanda, the Congo, Armenia, what's undeniable is that we're a disturbingly violent species. And there are even more distressing questions. What makes the 20th century the most advanced century in history, the most genocidal too? As the journalist Mark Bowden has put it, the Holocaust disturbs us so much because none of the things we associate with modern civilization, peace, industry, technology, education, frees us from the dark side of the human soul. He said that just as there is evil at the heart of every man, there is evil at the heart of even the most civilized human society. And the German philosopher Jürgen Habermas has said that a veil of naivety was torn up with the Holocaust. Something happened that was unimaginable until then. It ended the optimism of what seemed like the inexorable progress of Western enlightenment.
I want to focus on a kind of inoculation against that kind of evil, a moral vaccine. A social psychologist, Thomas Blass, puts it this way. What psychological mechanism transformed the average and presumably normal citizens of Germany and its allies into people who would carry out or tolerate unimaginable acts of cruelty against their fellow citizens who were Jewish, resulting in the death of 6 million of them? But first, a definition.
The UN says that genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group as such. A, killing members of the group. B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. And E, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group.
So what are the psychological, cultural, social and political factors that might lead ordinary men and women to commit crimes of this scale? We'll look here at a number of factors: propaganda, outgrouping, rationalization, authority, conformity, and compartmentalization or distancing. But rather than the Nazi leaders, those ordinary men might be a good place to start. That scene of Major Trapp tearfully informing his men of their duty did actually happen. Trapp was a police officer who commanded Reserve Police Battalion 101 of the Order Police. He was executed for war crimes in 1948. The Order Police were made up of ordinary Germans, too old to be conscripted into the army. They were around 33 to 48 years old, predominantly working class, but also too old to have only known Nazi propaganda, as they were raised in the democratic era of the Weimar Republic.
These ordinary policemen joined SS units called the Einsatzgruppen, who were tasked with following the army into occupied territories in the east, particularly Russia and Poland. They were to assist the SS in a number of jobs and, as their name suggests, keep order, rounding up Polish soldiers, guarding camps, organising equipment, and ultimately executing enemy soldiers, partisans, and Jews. Stalin had given the order for partisan warfare, which made it easier politically for Hitler to order communists in occupied Russia to be immediately executed because they were a threat. The nation, he argued, was being attacked from all sides. Germany was at war, and as one order noted, the men are to be instructed continuously about the political necessity of the measures. In June 1942, Police Battalion 101 was sent for guard duty to a town called Lublin in Poland, where around 40,000 Jews lived. In July, Major Trapp was ordered to round up the 1,800 Jews living in a nearby village. Working-age men were to be sent to a labour camp. The elderly, women and children were to be immediately shot. When Trapp's lieutenant was informed of the order, he requested another assignment, insisting that he would not participate in an action in which defenceless men and women would be shot. Before being told of the details, the men were informed that they would be doing some difficult work. One sergeant told them that he didn't want to see any cowards. They arrived at the village at dawn. Trapp assembled his men and said that any of the older men who didn't feel up to the task could step down. One man stepped forward, another 10 or 12 followed. They were dismissed. Almost 500 men remained. They were to round up the Jews and take them to the marketplace. Trapp didn't join his men. He couldn't bear the sight. One of the men reported hearing Trapp say that, "Oh God, why did I have to be given these orders?" He apparently paced back and forth. Another officer reported that Trapp had told him that the job didn't suit him, but that orders were orders. One said that when he and Trapp were alone, he sat on a stool and wept bitterly. The tears really flowed, he said. Another confirmed that he wept like a child. Meanwhile, the air was filled with gunshots and screams. A doctor explained to the men that shooting victims above the shoulders and into the backbone would result in an instant death. The executions lasted all day. Alcohol was supplied, but many aimed too high or too low. One man said that when he shot, the entire skull exploded. Brains and bones flew everywhere. Another said that the entire skull, or at least the rear skull cap, was torn off and blood, bone splinters and brain sprayed everywhere. After a while, many of the men just couldn't take it anymore. One policeman simply slipped off. Another avoided taking his turn shooting. Those who resisted were called weaklings, but suffered no consequences for not participating. Some hid in a priest's garden. Another said after one shooting, his nerves were totally finished. One man said he had become so sick that I simply couldn't anymore. Another ran into the woods and vomited. Many were sick, in fact. And the word repugnant was used a lot. One said he'd go crazy if he had to do it again. Some shot 10 or 20 Jews before they were asked to be relieved. One man said that his companion was such a terrible shot that the backs of heads were torn off and brain sprayed everywhere. He simply couldn't watch any longer. This is the testimony of some 200 men tried in a German court after the war. When they were finished, the bodies were left in the woods. And the men returned to the barracks, depressed, angered, embittered, and shaken, they said. None of them talked, none ate. They simply drank. In court, it was said that after only a brief period, the commandos of the Einsatzgruppen got into considerable difficulties. The members were in the long run not up to the mental strain caused by the mass shootings. There were disputes, refusals to obey orders, drunken orgies, but also serious psychological illnesses. Even Heinrich Himmler, commander of the SS and one of the architects of the Holocaust, was distraught after watching the execution of 100 men in Minsk. Another SS officer had said to him, "Look at the eyes of the men in this commando. How deeply shaken they are. These men are finished for the rest of their lives." But the men soon got used to killing.
I know that evening's empire has returned into sand, vanished from my hand, left me here to stand, standing all alone but still not sleeping. My weariness amazes me, I'm branded on my feet, I have no one to meet, and the ancient empty streets too dead for dreaming. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there's no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle-jangle morning, I'll come following you. Well, take me for a trip upon your magic swirling ship. All my senses have been stripped. My hands can't feel the grip, my toes too numb to step. Wait only for my boot heels to be wandering. I'm ready to go anywhere, I'm ready for the fade. On to my own parade, cast your dancing spell my way. I promise to go under it. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there's no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle-jangle morning, I'll come following you. Well, take me disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind, down the foggy ruins of time, far past the sheltered trees, past the haunted frozen leaves, out on the windy beach, far from the twisted reach of crazy sorrow. How to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the circus sand, with all memory and fate hidden far beneath the waves. Let me forget about today until tomorrow. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there's no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle-jangle morning, I'll come following you. Oh, you mighty laughing, skipping, spinning madly across the sun. It's not aimed at anyone, it's just escaping on the run. And but for the sky, there are no fences facing. And if you hear vague traces of skipping reels of rhyme to your tambourine in time, I wouldn't pay it any mind. It's just a ragged clown behind and a shadow that you've seen that he's chasing. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there's no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle-jangle morning, I'll come following you.
Thank you.
We're back. It's the Abolition of the Hour, 7:20 p.m. And we're going to listen to Eddie Jacobson talk about the Nazi SS breach of intelligence at the end of the war, Strasbourg, France. 4:23. Hit it, Mike.
Chapter 1, The War and the Weapons. It was November 26, 1944, and Strasbourg, France was still under attack. The cobblestone streets of this medieval city were in chaos. 3 days before, the 2nd French Armored Division had chased the Germans out of town and officially liberated the city from the Nazis. But now the Allies were having a difficult time holding the enemy back. German mortar rounds bombarded the streets. Air battles raged overhead. And in the center of town, inside a fancy apartment on Quai Clébard, armed U.S. soldiers guarded the Dutch-American particle physicist Samuel Goudsmit as he sat in an armchair scouring files. The apartment belonged to a German virus expert named Dr. Eugen Hagen, believed to be a key developer in the covert Nazi biological weapons program. Hagen had apparently fled his apartment in a hurry just a few days prior, leaving behind a framed photograph of Hitler on the mantel and a cache of important documents in the cabinets. Goudsmit and two colleagues, bacteriological warfare experts Bill Cromartie and Fred Wardenberg, had been reading over Dr. Hagen's documents for hours. Based on what was in front of them, they planned to be here all night. Most of Strasbourg was without electricity, so Goudsmit and his colleagues were reading by candlelight. Samuel Goudsmit led a unit engaged in a different kind of battle than the one being fought by the combat soldiers and airmen outside. Goudsmit and his team were on the hunt for Nazi science, German weaponry more advanced than what the Allies possessed. Goudsmit was scientific director of this top-secret mission, codename Operation Alsace, an esoteric and dangerous endeavor that was an offshoot of the Manhattan Project. Goudsmit and his colleagues were far more accustomed to working inside a laboratory than on a battlefield, and yet here they were in the thick of the fight. It was up to these men of science to determine just how close the Third Reich was to waging atomic, biological, or chemical warfare against Allied troops. This was called ABC warfare by Alsace. An untold number of lives depended on the success of the operation. Samuel Goudsmit had qualities that made him the mission's ideal science director. Born in Holland, he spoke Dutch and German fluently. At age 23, he had become famous among fellow physicists for identifying the concept of electronic spin. 2 years later, he earned his Ph.D. at the University of Leiden and moved to America to teach. During the war, Goudsmit worked on weapons development through a government-sponsored lab at MIT. This gave him unique insight into the clandestine world of atomic, biological, and chemical warfare, and had put him in this chair, reading quickly in the flickering candlelight. Just days before, Goudsmit's team had captured 4 of Hitler's top nuclear scientists and had learned from them that the Nazis' atomic bomb project had been a failure. This was an unexpected intelligence coup for Alsace and a huge relief. The focus now turned to the Reich's biological weapons program, rumored to be well advanced. Goudsmit and his team of Alsace agents knew that the University of Strasbourg had been doubling as a biological warfare research base for the Third Reich. Once a bastion of French academic prowess, this 400-year-old university had been taken over by the Reich Research Council, Hermann Göring's science organization, in 1941. Since then, the university had been transformed into a model outpost of Nazi science. Most of the university's professors had been replaced with men who were members of the Nazi Party and of Heinrich Himmler's SS. On this November night, Goudsmit made the decision to have his team set up camp in Professor Hagen's apartment and read all the documents in a straight shot. Alsace security team members set their guns aside, organized a meal of K rations on the dining room table, and settled into a long night of cards. Goudsmit and the biological weapons experts Cromarty and Wardenberg sat back in Professor Hagen's easy chairs and worked on getting through all the files. Night fell and it began to snow, adding confusion to the scene outside. Hours passed. Then Goudsmit and Wardenberg let out a yell at the same moment, remembered Goudsmit, for we had both found papers that suddenly raised the curtain of secrecy for us. There in Professor Hagen's apartment, in apparently harmless communication, lay hidden a wealth of secret information available to anyone who understood it. Goudsmit was not deciphering code. The papers were not stamped top secret. They were just the usual gossip between colleagues, ordinary memos, Goudsmit recalled. But they were memos that were never meant to be found by American scientists. The plan was for the Third Reich to rule for 1,000 years. Of the 100 prisoners you sent me, Hagen wrote to a colleague at the university, an anatomist named Dr. August Hurt, 18 died in transport. Only 12 are in a condition suitable for my experiments. I therefore request that you send me another 100 prisoners, between 20 and 40 years of age, who are healthy and in a physical condition comparable to soldiers. Heil Hitler, Professor Dr. Eugen Hagen. The document was dated November 15, 1943. For Samuel Goudsmit, the moment was a stunning reveal. Here, casually tucked away in a group of Hagen's personal papers, he had discovered one of the most diabolical secrets of the Third Reich. Nazi doctors were conducting medical experiments on healthy humans. This was new information to the scientific community, but there was equally troubling information in the subtext of the letter as far as biological weapons were concerned. Hagen was a virus expert who specialized in creating vaccines. The fact that he was involved in human medical experiments made a kind of twisted sense to Goudsmit in a way that few others could interpret. In order to successfully unleash a biological weapon against an enemy force, the attacking army had to have already created its own vaccine against the deadly pathogen it intended to spread. This vaccine would act as the shield for its own soldiers and civilians. The biological weapon would act as the sword. The document Goudsmit was looking at was a little more than a year old. How much vaccine progress had the Nazis made since? As Goudsmit stared at the documents in front of him, he was faced with a troubling reality. Once, Eugen Hagen had been a temperate man, a physician dedicated to helping people. In 1932, Dr. Hagen had been awarded a prestigious fellowship by the Rockefeller Foundation in New York City, where he had helped to develop the world's first yellow fever vaccine. In 1937, he had been a contender for the Nobel Prize. Hagen had been one of Germany's leading men of medicine. Now, here he was testing deadly vaccines on once healthy prisoners from concentration camps supplied to him by Himmler's SS. If a leading doctor like Hagen had been able to conduct these kinds of research experiments with impunity, what else might be going on? Goudsmit and his colleagues scoured Dr. Hagen's papers, paying particular attention to the names of the doctors with whom Hagen corresponded about his prisoner shipments, his vaccine tests, and his future laboratory plans. Goudsmit started putting together a list of Nazi scientists who were now top priorities for Alsace to locate, capture, and interview. Dr. Eugen Hagen would never become a paperclip scientist. After the war, he would flee to the Soviet zone of occupation in Germany and work for the Russians. But among the names discovered in his apartment were two physicians important to Operation Paperclip. They were Dr. Kurt Bloma, Deputy Surgeon General of the Third Reich, and Surgeon General Walter Scheiber. Dr. Bloma was in charge of the Reich's biological weapons programs. Dr. Scheiber was in charge of its vaccines, the sword and the shield. Before Hitler rose to power, Blauma and Schreiber had been internationally renowned physicians. Had Nazi science also made monsters of these men?
Ha!
It's the Abolitionist Hour, 7:41. We just listened to Annie Jacobson. Leslie West there doing House of the Rising Sun. And hit 429, Mike. And Bertrand Russell at one point wrote a book about Friedrich Nietzsche in 1927. And so this is Bertrand Russell's opinion of Friedrich Nietzsche, which is not that positive. But he points out the flaws in Nietzsche's framework. So 429.
Thank you, Alan. This next song, the title of the last album. I'll give you an example. Some of the shit you got to go through with these people. Like, the album's called Mistrial. I thought it was like an interesting word. You know, I wasn't exactly sure what it meant, but anyway, you got to do interviews with these people to sell records. So I had to talk to Rolling Stone, which is an experience in itself. But the girl from Rolling Stone, Lou, what is Mistrial? Do you feel guilty? Is this a song about the past? What past? I don't see any past here. It's called Mistrial.
I had my first lady. When I was 8, my first drink. When I was 14, I was feeding in the street. Hey, what could anybody say to me? Call me mister, you call me sir. Hey, don't you turn your finger in. I wanna be child. I wanna be child. When I was 30, my attitude was bad. Hey, if I said differently, it'd be a lot. But there's some smarts you learn down in the streets that no college education can buy. You call me mister, hey, you call me sir. Don't you point your finger. I want to sit down. I want to be tired.
down.
There is another element in Nietzsche which is closely akin to the objection urged by rugged individualists against trade unions. In a fight of all against all, the victor is likely to possess certain qualities which Nietzsche admires, such as courage, resourcefulness, and strength of will. But if the men who do not possess these aristocratic qualities, who are the vast majority, band themselves together, they may win in spite of their individual inferiority. In this fight of the collective canaille against the aristocrats, Christianity is the ideological front, as the French Revolution was the fighting front. We ought therefore to oppose every kind of union among the individually feeble, for fear lest their combined power should outweigh that of the individually strong. On the other hand, we ought to promote union among the tough and virile elements of the population. The first step towards the creation of such a union is the preaching of Nietzsche's philosophy. It will be seen that it is not easy to preserve the distinction between ethics and politics. Suppose we wish, as I certainly do, to find arguments against Nietzsche's ethics and politics. What arguments can we find? There are weighty practical arguments showing that the attempt to secure his ends will in fact secure something quite different. Aristocracies of birth are nowadays discredited. The only practicable form of aristocracy is an organization like the fascist or the Nazi party. Such an organization rouses opposition and is likely to be defeated in war, but if it is not defeated, it must before long become nothing but a police state, where the rulers live in terror of assassination and the heroes are in concentration camps. In such a community, faith and honor are sapped by delation, and the would-be aristocracy of supermen degenerates into a clique of trembling poltroons. These, however, are arguments for our time. They would not have held good in past ages when aristocracy was unquestioned. The Egyptian government was conducted on Nietzschean principles for several millennia. The governments of almost all large states were aristocratic until the American and the French revolutions. We have therefore to ask ourselves whether there is any good reason for preferring democracy to a form of government which has had such a long and successful history. Or rather, since we are concerned with philosophy, not politics, whether there are objective grounds for rejecting the ethic by which Nietzsche supports aristocracy. The ethical, as opposed to the political question, is one as to sympathy. Sympathy, in the sense of being made unhappy by the sufferings of others, is to some extent natural to human beings. Young children are troubled when they hear other children crying. But the development of this feeling is very different in different people. Some find pleasure in the infliction of torture. Others, like Buddha, feel that they cannot be completely happy so long as any living thing is suffering. Most people divide mankind emotionally into friends and enemies, feeling sympathy for the former but not for the latter. An ethic such as that of Christianity or Buddhism has its emotional basis in universal sympathy. Nietzsche's in a complete absence of sympathy. He frequently preaches against sympathy, and in this respect one feels that he has no difficulty in obeying his own precepts. The question is, if Buddha and Nietzsche were confronted, could either produce any argument that ought to appeal to the impartial listener? I am not thinking of political arguments. We can imagine them appearing before the Almighty, as in the first chapter of the book of Job, and offering advice as to the sort of world he should create. What could either say? Buddha would open the argument by speaking of the lepers, outcast and miserable. The poor toiling with aching limbs and barely kept alive by scanty nourishment. the wounded in battle, dying in slow agony, the orphans ill-treated by cruel guardians, and even the most successful haunted by the thought of failure and death. From all this load of sorrow, he would say, a way of salvation must be found, and salvation can only come through love. Nietzsche, whom only omnipotence could restrain from interrupting, would burst out when his turn came, "Good heavens, man, you must learn to be of tougher fiber. Why go about sniveling because trivial people suffer? Or, for that matter, because great men suffer? Trivial people suffer trivially. Great men suffer greatly, and great sufferings are not to be regretted because they are noble. Your ideal is a purely negative one, absence of suffering, which can be completely secured by non-existence. I, on the other hand, have positive ideals. I admire Alcibiades and the Emperor Frederick II and Napoleon. For the sake of such men, any misery is worthwhile. I appeal to you, Lord, as the greatest of creative artists, do not let your artistic impulses be curbed by the degenerate, fear-ridden maunderings of this wretched psychopath." Buddha, who in the courts of heaven has learnt all history since his death, and has mastered science with delight in the knowledge and sorrow at the use to which men have put it, replies with calm urbanity, "You are mistaken, Professor Nietzsche, in thinking my ideal a purely negative one. True, it includes a negative element, the absence of suffering, but it has in addition quite as much that is positive as is to be found in your doctrine. Though I have no special admiration for Alcibiades and Napoleon, I too have my heroes. My successor Jesus, because he told men to love their enemies. The men who discovered how to master the forces of nature and secure food with less labor. The medical men who have shown how to diminish disease. The poets and artists and musicians who have caught glimpses of the divine beatitude. Love and knowledge and delight in beauty are not negations. They are enough to fill the lives of the greatest men that have ever lived." "All the same," Nietzsche replies, "your world would be insipid. You should study Heraclitus, whose works survive complete in the celestial library. Your love is compassion, which is elicited by pain. Your truth, if you are honest, is unpleasant and only to be known through suffering. And as to beauty, what is more beautiful than the tiger who owes his splendor to his fierceness? No, if the Lord should decide for your world, I fear we should all die of boredom." "You might," Buddha replies, "because you love pain, and your love of life is a sham. But those who really love life would be happy as no one can be happy in the world as it is." For my part, I agree with Buddha as I have imagined him. But I do not know how to prove that he is right by any argument such as can be used in a mathematical or a scientific question. I dislike Nietzsche because he likes the contemplation of pain, because he erects conceit into a duty, because the men whom he most admires are conquerors whose glory is cleverness in causing men to die. But I think the ultimate argument against his philosophy, as against any unpleasant but internally self-consistent ethic, lies not in an appeal to facts, but in an appeal to the emotions. Nietzsche despises universal love. "I feel it the motive power to all that I desire as regards the world." His followers have had their innings, but we may hope that it is coming rapidly to an end.
Watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out.
Been watching cable TV with a female friend. I was watching news. World's in a mess. The poor and the hungry and the world distressed. Herpes, AIDS, the Middle East, and full throttle. Better check your sources before you're sticking in the wobbling. While you're at it, check what's in the batter. Make sure the candy's in original wrap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that batter. Make sure the candy's in original wrap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that batter. Make sure the candy's in original wrap. You better watch out, watch out, watch out. You better watch out, watch out, watch out. Reagan's
says that abortion's murder while he's staring at Cardinal O'Connor. Look at Jerry Falwell, Louis Farrakhan. The vote talk religion and the brotherhood of man. They both sound like they belong in Tehran. Hey, pitcher, you better check that batter. Make sure the candy's an original rap. And while you're at it, check what's in the batter. Make sure the candy's an original rap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that batter. Make sure the candy's an original rap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that batter. Make sure the candy's an original rap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that batter. Make sure the candy's an original rap. You better watch out, watch out, watch out. 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 Against you, it seems like it's 1942. The baby sits in front of MTV. He's watching his favorite fantasy while his dad guzzles beer to his favorite sport. Only find out his hero is all coked up. It's fantastic, original, the same old story. Politics are hate in a new surrounding set. Hate if it's good, hate if it's bad. If it's all dumb, I make it better, baby. I'll keep yours and honey, I'll keep mine. There's nothing sacred and there's nothing divine. Father, help me! Going and a food bottle better. Check the stars before you're sticking in the warm land. While you're at it, check what's in the banner. Make sure the candy's in the original wrap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that banner. Make sure the candy's in the original wrap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that banner. Make sure the candy's in the original wrap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that banner. Make sure the candy's in the original wrap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that banner. Make sure the candy's in the original wrap. You better watch out, watch out, watch out. Watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out. Watch out. Watch out, watch out, watch out. Watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out. But I grew up safe. I saw a lack of morals and a lack of concern. A feeling there's nowhere to turn. Hip as you hit up with mobile guns. Hey, don't you treat me like a sundown lion. Because the murderer lives, the victim dies. I try to steal a knife for an eye. And a heart for a heart, a brain for a brain. And if the soul don't make you feel insane, you better kick up your heels, turn the music up loud. Pick your guitar, look out at the crowd and say, don't mean to come on sanctimonious, but life's got me nervous and a little pugnacious. The goobious, I give you salutation and a rock on amp to beat. It's really stupid now. Who would do and how do you do it, baby? Hip, I'm a gonna bop till a drop. Hey, pitcher, you better check that banner, make sure the candy's in the original wrap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that banner, make sure the candy's in the original wrap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that banner, make sure the candy's in the original wrap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that banner, make sure the candy's in the original wrap. Hey, pitcher, you better check that banner, make sure the candy's in the original wrap. You better watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out. You better watch out, watch out, watch out. Watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out. Watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out.
Abolitionist Hour. It's 8.02 p.m. And we're going to hear from Noam Chomsky talking about Alexander Coburn. This is 428A. Hit it, Mike.
Thank you. Your body's sprawled out, you without a doubt, running people out. They're on the floor. Said bloody mess. Shot all up in the chest. Shot in the chest.
All right, we're live. We're live with Hibachi Lamar. And are you up on King and 64th Street, Lamar?
Yes, yes. Yep. And the community is it's a really strong-minded community. And there's a young brother right here who has something he likes to read. And I'm going to just let the brother speak. Here you go, brother.
Hello.
Hello. What do you got?
Hi, hello. How you doing, man? I got, I did some time in Texas, man, and I spent a lot of time in the law library, and I wrote something. It's called Slavery Forever Exists in Texas, and it's very deep when it comes to as far as slavery and during the whole time on parole and everything that has to do with that. And I feel like it's very, 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 very powerful, and I really like would appreciate if somebody could put this out. And because I feel like if I do it, parole will be on me, trying to lock me up for this, because this is something that you can actually get locked up for. Well, I can get locked up for because of how powerful it is. And he said something about that you have a radio station or something that, that y'all always talk on about. And,
Blog
I feel like
radio.
This is...
Yeah,
right.
You're on
you
Blog
said...
Talk.
Huh?
Yeah, you're on Blog Talk Radio. Go ahead and read it for us, please.
Okay. Slavery forever exists in Texas. The state of Texas board and pardons. Parole has the exclusive power to grant parole. Board's discretion. Texas government code on parole's liberty interest for the convict states, once a person is convicted of an offense, he has no constitutional rights to be released on parole before the completion of his or her sentence, regardless of good time or work time that was earned. This is the state's position in the findings in these two cases laws to be support their actions above. Is slavery by true and exact definition? Slavery 1, the condition of which one person is owned as property by another and is under the owner's control, especially in involuntary servitude, that states the servitude as the property of a slaveholder and a mode of production in which slaves constitute the principal workforce. For it to be called parole, there has to be constitutional rights of due process and liberty interest for the convict to go along with parole. Otherwise, it should be called slavery. It has to be one or the other. As long as government has ties to anything in the United States, there has to be constitutional rights for the people, even if they are incarcerated. The state of Texas is hiding behind the Board of Parole's discretion in order to revolutionize slavery without having to address any of the consequences of the judicial system as a state. Okay. Texas, along with the entire country, has abolished slavery in 1865 when the Civil War ended. Reformed slavery fully exists in Texas by way of world's largest prison system. 15 million prisoners in since 1989 in Texas alone. Texas inmates under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights article states, no one shall be held in slavery or servitude, and slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms. These are jobs taken from our community, over 100,000. Texas inmates have a right not to work, but forced to, or they will do their entire sentence in prison. A prisoner by constitutional and civil rights must be compensated legitimately for their work in prison. Good time in Texas is absolutely not compensation because it's never truly earned or kept. The inmate will ultimately sign all good time back over to TDC once they are released. The convict will do exactly every single minute of their sentence in prison on parole, period. The Texas penal system encourages the prisoners that they have no constitutional rights or liberty interest and deserves no pay for millions of hours work, making TDCJ literally billions of dollars over these years. They also receive federal funding. Inmates work outside contracts with TDCJ for profit, and they are on stock market for the unlimited products convicts make. All money hidden in private accounts. The real purpose of prison is to separate the inmates from society for a specific period of time, not to be misled by parole or mistreated by officials, forced labor, and harsh living conditions. These are victims being punished beyond that, which is necessary for orderly control of the prison system. Okay? The sign at the borderline says, "Don't mess with Texas." It's one of the only two things. One, a very illegal and unlawful treat to us, which should really bother us. Two, or its slavery mentality. We have to be proud and accept our culture. We good slaves, boss. The Texas Parole Board is using the nature of the crime and the prisoner's criminal history to justify denying their parole and freedom. The trial court judge has already used the same criteria of sentencing. The reform is double jeopardy, constitutional violations of the Fifth Amendment. Slavery shall be ended with the Civil War, but the rights of all races are abused in Texas. The state believes it's above the law, and their oppressive, outdated, and counterproductive ways start in the corrupt courts all the way up to the reformed slavery in the Texas prison system. These jobs pay civilians $20 to $50 per hour in our communities. 100,000 jobs or more, if we strike, will be punished and lose parole for false reasons. Texas inmates strike for better prison conditions. The state of Texas prison system includes its government supporters stand firm the issue of slavery through its prison system and will protect it by all costs, including taking lives. It seems impossible, but all a person has to do is look up the parole code, and it'll tell you it's discretion to give parole, not a right. They will let you go on. They will let you go only because they need a bed for a new inmate. Most are afraid to challenge these issues, but something has to be done. They have disregarded the lives of inmates and their families. DMS stands for Discretionary Mandatory Supervision. It's a contradiction of words. It's either or. They believe we are stupid. It's mandatory. It's discretionary. TDCJ is a government-funded institution and should not be allowed to separate itself from the constitutional rights of prisoners. It's illegal. Parole is acting the legislative, judicial, and executive branches simultaneously to keep the prison system put forward for profit. TCI, Texas Correctional Industries, was behind unpaid prison labor in Texas. For sake of the thousands that are affected by this nefarious system, do as much as you can to give us back our rights and spread the news of this injustice to everyone so just justice will prevail. Post on social media, websites, radio, TV. Just Help Texas provides no more than a mere hope for parole, which isn't protected by due process. The content of this letter states all facts. The truth stands more without any help. Hope for parole is not enough if we earned it. And that's it right there.
All right. Texas incarcerated workers, they're going to be striking. There's a nationwide prison strike.
Yes, sir.
Coming up in August.
Can you repeat that?
There's a nationwide prison strike in August.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, in August?
Yes.
Okay, okay.
Middle of August to the middle of September.
Okay. How do we go far about this? Is it any way that I can because I have more information on a lot of things that could be, you know, talked about as far as when it comes to racial and prison system. Is it any way that I can take your number down and you know, we can go over some things and discuss some things?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. My name is Jesse.
Jesse, Jesse from Texas?
Here, I'll put you in the...
No, I'm from Chicago. I'm from Chicago, Illinois, but I served time in Texas.
Well, welcome back. Welcome back, Jesse.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you.
We appreciate you getting in touch with us.
Yes, sir.
We'll,
for sure.
And it's okay that we repost this, what you told us.
Yes, sir. For sure. Yes, sir.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, love and struggle.
Yes, sir. Talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, Mike. We were at 428.
Okay.
Oh, didn't care nothing about want to help me out, Randy?
You, what you know, many of you better than me, I'll just keep to a couple of personal reminiscences, which you couldn't know. I guess the most enjoyable moments I spent with Alex were in Ireland. In fact, my wife and I, Carol and I, were in Ireland about 20 years ago, and Alex happened to be there at the same time. He picked us up in Dublin and drove us down to the family home down in the south. And we spent a couple days there, very delightful days, talking endlessly about every possible topic, roaming through the countryside, visiting nearby places, and in general doing what I guess my grandchildren would call hanging out. You know, no obligations, no commitments, very rare experience for me, but a very memorable one. So for example, one evening he took us over to a local pub in the town right nearby, and a couple of guys sitting in the back, friends of his, playing some kind of game, drinking, of course, singing. One of them was introduced as a former boxing champion of Ireland, kind of looked the part. We joined them. Then after a while and a couple of drinks, they enticed us into joining them, singing some songs together, a duet. For Carol, it was no problem. For me, it was a terrifying experience. But we managed. We couldn't think of any Irish songs, but we kind of made do with Welsh and Scottish songs that we kind of dredged up from memories, partly. A lot of missing phrases. You wouldn't I wouldn't subject you to my part of that performance, but it was a very pleasant, relaxed, lovely evening. I think the kind of company that Alex just enjoyed being with, it was great to be part of it. One afternoon he took us over to Cork, the town nearby, just to show us sights of his early years and experiences. One of them was an old church, which had an interesting history. I just know from what Alex told me, apparently it kept fluctuating over the years between Catholic and Protestant, depending on who had more guns that year. And he said it didn't seem to matter much. It stayed pretty much the same. When we were there, it was Protestant, but the caretaker who took us around was Catholic, or maybe the other way around. I don't remember. But on the back wall of the church, Alex pointed to a slit in the wall way up high, and he said it was called the Leper's Peak. Lepers weren't allowed in the church, but they were allowed to climb up on a ladder on the outside and peek in. And it kind of struck me that that would be a great title for Alex's next collection of essays. He made sure that his targets in the establishment, who he eviscerated with such verve and precision, would regard him as a very dangerous leper, and one who's always peeking in, no matter how much they try to keep him out, and exposing what they're up to. And he did it in remarkable ways. Actually, one of the parts that I appreciated particularly was that he always did his homework, which is very rare and hard. So, like Tarek, the whatever journal he was writing in, the first article I'd turn to would be his, and was always very informative. I learned important things, and also flavored with his unique wit and style. Being in the house for a couple of days, you kind of got the sense that it was permeated by the achievements of this quite remarkable family. I hope I won't embarrass you, but the three brothers we know in their different and remarkable ways. Their father, who Tarek was talking about. And just recently we learned from Patrick's research about their grandfather, who it turns out was maybe the earliest critic of the crime of rendition. He was in the British Foreign Service in Korea, and he very harshly criticized what he called rendition in exactly the contemporary sense, the British sending a Korean prisoner to the Japanese, of course, to be tortured, which illustrates that the rot runs very deep, and so does the much too occasional, but very real courage to combat it. Now, that's a really important legacy. One of the problems of living too long is that a lot of your friends disappear. In the last couple of years, there's been a series of inspiring voices that have been still just keeping to some close friends of mine, also Alex's, Edward Said, who was mentioned, Iqbal Ahmed, Howard Zinn, now Alex. I do think they're irreplaceable, but they do leave us with a standard that they set, something to, not to emulate, because that can't be done, but at least to try to approach. And that's a task of extraordinary importance.
This always was one of my true favorites. I thought it was like this great romantic song. And I, being one of the world's great unrecognized romantics, it's always a turn on for me to get to sing one of my own romantic songs in public. Satellite's gone up to the skies. Things like that, they drive me right out of my mind. Well, I watched it for a little while. I like to watch things on.
Satellite of love. Sad.
the Abolitionist Hour, it's 8:40 p.m. We have turned the corner on this weekend's podcast. Is there a better place to be than Kansas City on a Saturday night during this interwar period? My answer is no, there's not a better place. Okay, so we're gonna finish up our last clip, and then we'll say goodbye. And it's 4:27. Hit it, Mike.
Now, there's something I'd like to talk to you about at this particular moment, and that's about the one thing that we won't be able to do together unless we all become as one. And if we all become as one, and then we can walk through it together. Now, I ain't walked through it all the way yet, but there was a time I walked into it, and I had to go into it alone. That's this place called the Halls of Karma. Now, when you go into the Halls of Karma the way I did, I don't know, it might have been hallucination, but I think it was real. See, I felt the presence of the two energies, positive and the negative, of God and the devil, however you want it. And they was pulling and deciding on one of them what to do with my soul. Now, I couldn't take this at this moment because I had to come back to be with you people. Do a thing, and I proved to them in bargaining with them that I had a thing to do for the good of all of us. Out of this bargain, the devil, he got my body for the good and his needs while I'm here on earth, and the Lord, he's got my mind for the good of the universe and for the good of man, and they got me in between because they both got my soul. So the next time I come up, I want the Lord to please have mercy on my soul.
Everybody makes the original mistake in an English school the first time they see those letters written across a map. And it says Arkansas, but everybody says Arkansas. That's mistake number one. Mistake number two, everybody thinks out of the Ozarks, all you see is the Beverly Hillbillies. Totally disproved. No mistake. From the United States of America, Atlantic recording artist, Black Oak, Arkansas.
It's time to let the mighty eagle soar once more. Let the eagle soar like she's never soared before. From rocky coast to golden shore.
For nobody. We like working for ourselves, is that right? And nobody likes working for the...
Guys, that song was written by Lincoln Chase and covered in 1973 by Black Oak, Arkansas. It hit number 25 on the pop chart and featured Jim Mangrum, who had already been using Jim Dandy as a stage name before they covered the song, and female vocalist Ruby Starr trading off vocals. It was the first single from their 1973 album, High on the Hog, the band's most commercially successful album. Well, we are back. Our featured guest segment is sponsored by Hip and Hippie. Hip and Hippie is a planet-loving company known for its high-quality, earth-friendly, 100% recyclable candle line and natural body care products. It's no wonder eco-supporting people love Hip and Hippie. HipandHippie.com.
This week, Attorney General John Ashcroft became the first member of President Bush's cabinet to step down since the election. Here to talk about his resignation is John Ashcroft.
Thank you, Tina. It's been an honor serving as the Attorney General of this great nation. For 4 years, I've enjoyed widespread popular support for the many fine decisions that I've made. My Patriot Act, a real favorite with everybody, has allowed law enforcement agencies to arrest thousands of people, some of whom may in fact turn out to be guilty of something. But alas, I've wanted to do so much more, like banning nudie pictures from art museums, making a secret list of bearded people, creating a law that people have to sleep with their hands outside their blankets. But very few of my modest proposals were ever taken seriously. Simple things that I know that we could agree on. For instance, I wanted to bring good old-fashioned wooden stocks back to the town square and let people heave rocks and tomatoes at the folks who was guilty of spitting on the sidewalk. I had the brilliant idea to put lojacks on Muslims in this country, so we want to put a lojack on them so we could be keeping track of them. I wanted dirty magazines to explode with black ink so we could see who's a-buying them. It was my plan to arrest people who walked around at night, and like you, Tina, I thought the missionary sex position should be written into the Constitution as the only true and legal way to do that disgusting deed. But not everybody saw things our way, Tina, and so I'm resigning.
A sad day for all America.
You really think so?
No.
Well, all right then, let's jump on this and see if we can ride it bareback.
Ride me next.
future.
The Abolitionist Hour, 8:55 p.m. Hope you all enjoyed the podcast tonight. That was Black Oak, Arkansas, featuring Attorney General John Ashcroft. And most of you remember when Ashcroft resigned. And what was interesting was he was a war criminal because he failed to prosecute the war in Iraq. He didn't investigate the Nigerian yellow cake mud that has about as much uranium as your front yard. Yeah, let this soak in. So yeah, what it rested on one guy. What is it? Nietzsche said, "Great men suffer greatly." Well, John Ashcroft.
Go on, Carl. Tell him how he got it. Tell him how he got in the hospital bed.
He drank him. You can. We've seen this happen at Westport, where you can drink so much alcohol, particularly liquor, say vodka. And your liver becomes so toxic, it becomes you develop sepsis. At that point, you're in ICU. And so the legend is it's an urban legend now what happened. But so he's dying, and he's got five tubes in him and ready to flatline. And they're wanting John Ashcroft to sign the order for torture. Extraordinary rendition. And there's reports that his wife, John Ashcroft's wife, was actually swinging at these federal agents. Getting the... and of course...
Signed the paper.
Exactly.
Another part of the rumor was that, and it could be fact, I wouldn't be surprised, that Dick Cheney called him up and ordered him to get over there and get that signature before John Boy Ashcroft.
And now look how the pendulum has shifted. Now the Montana militia is going after... Or the Wyoming militia is going after Liz Cheney.
Liz Cheney?
Yeah, the pendulum has swung the other direction. Yeah, she's like the moderate conservative.
Oh, for the right.
Liz Cheney is the voice of reason out in Jackson Hole, Montana, or Wyoming.
Oh, what times we live in.
And you know, and here's the thing. I meant to do a clip on Edna St. Vincent Molloy, the first woman poet laureate in 1923. And
yeah.
it's an amazing story. And somehow it ended up with John Ashcroft in Black Oak, Arkansas.
Right.
So
it's Saturday night, guys. Saturday night, you know.
Another one of T.B. Slim's songs.
Good night.
Plague, oh, wild, simply wild over me. Although I've never done them harm that I can see. I'm as gentle as a lamb, but they take me for a ram. They go wild, simply wild over me. Oh, the cop, he went wild over me. And he held his gun where everyone could see. He was breathing rather hard when he saw my union card. He went wild, simply wild over me. Then the judge, he went wild over me. And I plainly saw we never could agree. So I...